Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in California against Sierra Club and the consolidated case. Mr. Wellston.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case raises very important issues of federalism with respect to the control of water resources in the West. There are actually two major issues raised in this case with respect to the meaning of the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899. The first question is whether under Section 10 of that Act, the Army Corps of Engineers has authority to override state water rights laws even where there are no impacts upon federal navigation interests. The second issue is whether the 1899 Act affords a private right of action that is available to the plaintiffs in this case.
Logically, isn't the second issue that you mentioned really logically the first issue?
It is indeed. I've arranged them chronologically, right. Justice Stewart, for the reason that I will argue only the first question.
I see.
Because we did not raise the second issue in our briefs. The United States will argue the second issue in behalf of the petitioners. Briefly, the facts of the case are very complicated, but I will try to just very briefly skip over them as I may. The case involves water exports by the State Water Project, which is a massive reclamation project in California that essentially exports waters from the northern part of the state to the central and the southern parts of the state. The projects actually release waters that flow downstream into the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, and then pumping plants on the south end of the delta pump the waters to the users in central and southern California. This project is extremely vital to California's economic health. It provides a water supply to about 14 million people, which is over half of California's population. It provides irrigation water to about 1 million acres of prime agricultural land. And in fact, the state project has been in operation since 1967, so it's been exporting water since that period.
The Central Valley Project was authorized before the federal government made any contribution to it at all, wasn't it?
That's correct. The Central Valley Project is a federal reclamation facility that essentially parallels the state facility, and it's been operational since the 1930s. The precise issue in this case is whether Section 10 of the Act authorizes the Corps of Engineers to control the allocation of water from this project, pursuant to Section 10 of the Act. Section 10 essentially contains two clauses that are before the Court. The first clause is, in our view, the major clause. It establishes a general prohibition against obstructions to navigable capacity without the approval of Congress. And the third clause makes it unlawful to alter the condition of navigable waters without approval of the Army Corps of Engineers. And the state's argument may be briefly summarized as follows. Section 10, in our view, applies only where there's an effect on navigable capacity, as that term is used within the meaning of the first clause. And therefore, Section 10 applies only where there is an effect upon federal navigation interests. Now the question, does Section 10 apply to water allocations that are adopted by the states under their water rights laws? And on that question, we raise essentially two alternative arguments. First, we argue that Section 10 does not apply to state water allocations at all. Second, we argue that if Section 10 does apply in that context, the Court should develop a kind of common law or rule of reason test governing its meaning in that kind of situation. And under this rule of reason test, we argue that Section 10 should apply to state water allocations only where there is a substantial effect upon the capacity of waters to support actual navigation in the area where commerce actually takes place. To state it very briefly, we argue that Section 10 applies only where to state water allocations, only where there is a substantial effect upon federal navigation interests and concerns. Now, the Court of Appeals rejected our analysis. It held that Section 10 applies even whenever there is an effect on the condition of navigable waters, even though there may be no effect on navigation or navigable capacity. In other words, Section 10 applies without regard to the existence of federal navigation interests. And it further held that Section 10 fully applies to state water allocations and that the court should not develop any kind of common law or rule of reason test with respect to the meaning of Section 10 in that situation.
Well, when you talk about federal common law, do you mean something different than a construction of Section 10? Do you want us to overrule Erie against Tompkins?
No, we mean precisely a construction of Section 10, Justice Rehnquist. It is the same construction of Section 10, indeed, that this court rendered in 1899 in the Rio Grande case. And at that time, the court held that the Section 10 applies only where there is a substantial effect on navigable capacity in an area where navigation is a recognized fact. That's precisely the language of the court's decision. So the court in that case appeared to adopt a rule of reason test, which we regard as kind of a common law test. If the Court of Appeals' interpretation of Section 10 is correct, then we concede that Section 10 fully applies here. For the water exports in this case do affect the condition of navigable waters, and we concede that. But if our interpretation of Section 10 is correct, then Section 10 does not apply in this case, because the state water project exports in this case do not substantially affect navigable capacity in that part of the delta where commerce actually takes place. The exports at most reduce water levels in the delta by only about 1 inch in that part of the delta where commerce actually takes place. And this reduction has no substantial effect on actual federal navigation interests in that part of the delta. Now, a rule of reason test is in essence an attempt to accommodate conflicting, or at least potentially conflicting, goals in the subjects on the subjects of navigation and reclamation. Specifically, we are urging this court to attempt an accommodation between federal navigation interests on the one hand and the congressional policy on the other hand of deferring to the water right laws and the water supply systems that have been developed by the western states. Indeed, the very purpose of the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899 was to prevent obstructions to navigable capacity, and thus to protect federal environmental federal navigation concerns. And this court has held that that act was passed for the very purpose of overcoming this court's decision in the Willamette Bridge case, a case in which this court held that there is no federal common law with respect to obstructions to navigation. And therefore, in our view, the 1899 Act should be applied at least in this situation only where there is an effect, an actual effect, on actual visible federal navigation interests. And this result, we believe, is reinforced by the concept that Congress has historically delegated broad authority and control to the western states to control their water rights system. This delegation of authority is based upon several laws that were passed by Congress both this century and in the prior century relating to the subjects of reclamation, desert lands, mining, and a vast array of other types of subject matters. And under this delegation of authority, the western states have actually developed administrative water rights systems in which they have been trying and successfully trying to control and manage their water resources. And indeed, the water exports in this very case have been authorized under California's own water rights system. California's own water rights system is controlled by the State Water Resources Control Board, which has authorized the allocation of the exports of water in this case, subject, however, to conditions that were intended to protect the environmental quality of the delta itself. These state water allocation systems that have been developed by the western states are absolutely vital to their economic growth and prosperity. The West is unique in many ways, and Congress has dealt with it, with the West, in a unique way. The West has much land but very little water. And so the western states have, in effect, developed reclamation systems for the purpose of transporting water from where it originates to where it may be used and where it is needed by human beings.
When you say the delta, does that go up as far as Stockton?
Yes, it does, Mr. Justice. Under the Court of Appeals decision, the Corps of Engineers, however, could override potentially any state water allocation that is authorized under state water rights laws as long as there is an effect on the condition of navigable waters, even though there may be no effect whatsoever upon navigation or navigable capacity. Well, in practical reality, most state water allocations affect the condition of navigable waters. Thus, as a practical matter, the Court of Appeals decision would allow the Corps of Engineers essentially to control most water allocations that are authorized under the water rights laws of the western states. If this is so, then the Corps of Engineers would function as kind of a super water agency in the west. It would be responsible for ultimately controlling the diversion of water and the division of water among competing economic and environmental interests in the western states. For example, it could determine the allocation of water between competing agricultural groups, or between competing urban groups, or between competing agricultural and urban users.
Can I interrupt you there for a moment? It could not properly do so, could it? Because its only interest in the allocation would be in protecting the navigation. The interest in free navigation.
That would be our position, Justice Stevens, but the Court of Appeals held that the Corps of Engineers could go beyond that situation and could control water allocations even where there is no effect upon federal navigation.
Only to the extent that you have to get a permit before you go forward.
Yes, that's correct.
And if they reviewed the facts and said, well, the only thing that's at stake here is an inch change in the water table or something like that, wouldn't we expect them to grant the permit? They wouldn't deny it because they think they'd rather have stock and have the business than San Joaquin or something like that.
Well, it's difficult to say exactly what the Corps of Engineers would do with that kind of situation, but under the Corps of Engineers regulations, it could look to any public interest factor in determining whether the water should be used for one purpose or the other. In other words, the state would determine that the water should be used by one particular group of farmers in one particular region. And under the Court of Appeals decision, the Corps of Engineers could effectively...
The Corps of Engineers say you're going to build a bridge across the river, and somebody says we've got to have a permit. You think they could deny the permit if they found that there would be no interference with navigation, but they just didn't think it was in the public interest to build a bridge?
That's what the Court of Appeals said, Justice Stevens.
Do you think the Corps of Engineers could override the provisions of the Reclamation Act of 1902?
No, we don't believe that.
You think the Court of Appeals thought it could?
Yes, I think the Court of Appeals assumed that the Corps of Engineers is not governed by Section 8 of the Reclamation Act of 1902. This court held recently in California versus United States that Section 8 of that 1902 Act gives the states very broad control of reclamation. But the Court of Appeals addressed that question and said that the state's power simply does not apply in any situation where the Corps of Engineers is exercising its powers under the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899. In effect, the Court of Appeals read Section 8 out of the Act insofar as it applies to water diversions that might fall within the parameters of the Corps of Engineers' authority under the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899. To pursue the point, the power that is thus given to the Corps of Engineers under the Court of Appeals decision is immensely broad. The Corps could determine, for example, that it's better for Los Angeles to achieve more urban growth than for California's Central Valley to produce more food. Or it could determine just the opposite. And under the Court of Appeals decision, the Corps of Engineers could make that determination irrespective of the effect upon federal navigation interests and concerns. There is nothing in the language or the legislative history of the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899 that provides any indication that Congress ever intended for such a massive federal intrusion into an area that has been traditionally regulated by the states themselves.
Did this lawsuit originate as a suit by the Corps of Engineers against the state of California, or was it a privately instituted lawsuit?
It was a privately instituted lawsuit. The plaintiffs in the case are the Sierra Club and other groups in and around the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. The Corps of Engineers, or I should say to be more precise, certain federal officials were sued as co-defendants along with the state of California.
Well, so the federal Corps of Engineers acting under the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899 was not complaining about what California was doing by way of diversion through the the Tracy plant and so forth.
No, the Corps of Engineers was not complaining at all. That's correct, Justice Rehnquist. This is a private lawsuit brought by the Sierra Club and other private groups against the state and the federal government. The Corps of Engineers' own regulations, by the way, provide an indication of the potential breadth of the Corps' authority over the state water rights systems that have been adopted by the western states. Under the Corps' own regulations, the Corps is authorized to consider any factor relating to the public interest, quote, end quote, in the process of approving or denying a permit application. And the regulations even define the factors that relate to the public interest. And these factors are, among other things, water supply, food production, land use, aesthetics.
How much of this is speculation, as long as the Corps, with this broad body of regulations, was simply leaving you alone until a private cause of action was asserted?
Well, it's difficult to say what position the United States and the Corps of Engineers would now take with respect to the state water diversions in this case.
Well, you know what position they take on the merits from the brief filed in this case, don't you?
Beg pardon?
You know their position from their brief filed in this case.
That's precisely that's the point. Prior to this lawsuit, the Corps of Engineers had never complained about the state water diversions and had not sought to exercise any kind of jurisdiction.
But now you know that the Corps of Engineers
exactly
believes that the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit was correct.
That's exactly correct, Justice Stewart. And for that reason, we would strongly urge that this Court reach the merits of the case, regardless of what disposition it might make with respect to the procedural question of whether
how
the plaintiffs have a private right of action.
How could we? If there's no private right of action, how possibly could we reach
the merits? Perhaps you could not, Justice Stewart, but we would hope that the Court might
naturally
perform
so,
something in the way of...
You hope we'll decide the private cause of action the other way.
Yes, that's correct.
But if we don't, how can we possibly reach the merits?
Well, the Court has on occasion made alternative holdings, and that's the kind of thing we would look to in this case if the Court upholds our private right of action.
But we have to get over the threshold first before we can get to alternative holdings, don't we?
That is perhaps correct,
well,
Mr. Chief Justice.
If we said there wasn't a private cause of action, I suppose you'd set aside all the opinions and judgments in the case.
Yes.
And wouldn't you win then or not?
Well, we wouldn't really win, Justice White, because we have to go back to California, and then we wouldn't know whether we are subject to the Corps of Engineers jurisdiction or not. We wouldn't know that for several years until the case got back to this court. And in the meantime, we really wouldn't.
What case?
The Corps of Engineers might then say, might say to you, might bring an action to enjoin you.
Yes. I would assume that the Corps of Engineers in the future would take the same position that is taking as now.
And that the Delta plant is in. Needs a permit.
Right. And we would obviously take the same position that we take now, to the effect that the pumping plants do not need a permit.
Well, why do you think the Corps of Engineers did not take the position that the Delta plant required a permit before this lawsuit was brought?
I simply have no idea, Justice Rehnquist. You may want to ask the United States that question.
You didn't ask for
it. No, that's correct. We have applied for a permit in this case, but only under protest and in response to the decisions of the lower courts in this case. But our application has been under protest.
How did Cecil Anders get to be a party in this case?
The federal defendants were sued because the Sierra Club claimed that the federal Central Valley Project also needed permits approved by the Corps of Engineers under the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899. In other words, there were really two reclamation projects before this court. One is a federal project that was developed and built by the federal government.
I suppose technically in the district court, the United States might have counterclaimed or cross-claimed against one of the defendants, against you, to enjoin the current Delta plant.
It might have done that, and in light of its present...
It hasn't done that until now.
No. In light of its present position, I would expect that it should have done that. But I think it did not do that for the reason that its position on the issues in this case was apparently not clear at the time of the district court action.
Well, what if it had said in its brief here, we would like the case remanded so we can file a cross-claim, or please accept us as a cross-claim?
We would have no objection to that. We want to reach the merits in any way that's possible, and if that's If the merits can be reached that way, then we would welcome that alternative.
Because your feared opponent is here.
That's right, and they will be addressing this court shortly. But if the court doesn't reach the merits of the case, we will, as I say, be operating the state water project for the next few years without really knowing whether we're required to obtain a permit or not. And the same will apply with respect to the Peripheral Canal, which is one of the current hottest political issues in California. We simply don't know at this point, and we won't know until this court resolves the question, whether we are required to obtain a permit for the Peripheral Canal or not. And we apparently, if the court disposes of this case on procedural grounds, the matter won't be resolved until a new case.
If it's a hot political issue, we may never have to reach it.
Well, that's always a possibility.
To say disposing of it on procedural grounds, I mean, if the person who initiated the lawsuit was not authorized by Congress to initiate the lawsuit, that's scarcely procedural grounds.
You know, call it what you will.
Well, it's perhaps your point is correct, but whatever the grounds, the approach you're suggesting would be one way for the court not to reach the merits of the lawsuit, which we define as the meaning of Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act. Our concern in the case is that the court ultimately resolve the meaning of Section 10 as it applies in this situation. We just simply don't know how to operate the state water project without some determination by this court. We've got a decision by the Ninth Circuit, which is adverse, and presumably any district court would follow the Ninth Circuit's decision in any future litigation. Certainly, we would expect the United States to bring a lawsuit against the state of California if the state does not apply for the permit which the United States feels to be necessary.
You can always wait for the Tenth Circuit to speak.
May I ask about the status of the permit application first? I know you've done it under protest, but do they cover the Peripheral Canal as well as the operation of the Delta Pumping Plant?
No. There has been no application for a permit for the Peripheral Canal.
Just wondering why. But what's happening to the Delta Pumping Plant right now? Is it operating?
Yes, it is operating. The Court of Appeals held that the pumping plant was required to, that the state was required to obtain a permit for the pumping plant, but it stayed its injunction with respect to that part of the case. So the injunction,
no,
in effect,
is made for the Peripheral Canal.
No, that's correct, Justice Stevens. Part of that is that we believe that no application is necessary for the reasons I have argued.
Also believe no application is necessary for the Delta Pumping Plant.
Right. That's correct. The difference, I believe, though, is that the pumping plants are currently in operation, and we want to do everything we can to keep them going. The Peripheral Canal has not yet been built. And indeed, there is a local California referendum that will decide the fate of the canal that will be acted upon by the California electorate within the next 18 months. So it is not as immediate.
That's all the more reason to go ahead with a permit application. We've got plenty of time to see what the Army Corps of Engineers thinks about it.
That's one way to proceed, but if we're not required to obtain a permit, then obviously perhaps we should not. So there we are again.
Conceded in the case that there is Article 3 jurisdiction in the sense of a case or controversy between these plaintiffs and defendants?
We have made no allegation that there is no case or controversy, and I don't see.
Well, I know you want to decide it.
Right, but I also believe that there is a case or controversy. I don't, perhaps I'm not following you, Justice White.
Well, the plaintiffs are the Sierra Club, Friends of the Earth, Hank Schramm, a fisherman, and Dixon, a landlord.
That's correct.
What stakes in this controversy do any of those people have?
Well, you'll have to really ask the Sierra Club, the petition, the respondents,
right,
more what their interest is, but I think they're...
I don't want to waste your time.
Okay.
You go ahead.
Fine. The approach which we're suggesting to this court, again, I emphasize, focuses on the existence of federal navigation interests and concerns. And this approach is intended to preserve the traditional institutional roles that have been carried out by the Corps of Engineers in the western states with respect to the control and management of water resources in the West. The Corps of Engineers has traditionally focused on navigation and has traditionally been concerned with navigation, but not with water allocation. By the same token, the states have traditionally focused on water allocation and, under the congressional delegation of authority that I mentioned earlier, have traditionally been responsible for allocating water among competing needs in the West. Therefore, the Corps has no particular expertise over this subject matter. The states, on the other hand, have a lot of expertise on this subject. But the Court of Appeals decision would effectively allow the Corps to essentially usurp this historic role occupied by the states and begin to take over this role for the Corps of Engineers itself. It would allow the Corps essentially to occupy a role that has been historically occupied by the western states. So our approach is designed to achieve some kind of accommodation or balance between federal and state interests, federal navigation interests and state reclamation interests. On the one hand, our approach would prevent the states from impairing federal navigation interests and therefore would protect the federal concerns that underlie the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899. But on the other hand, our approach would authorize the states to reclaim their arid lands in situations where there are no impacts upon federal navigation interests. So in that sense, we are urging that this court seek some kind of accommodation or balance between federal and state interests. And I emphasize once again very strongly that this court has in effect followed and adopted the very approach which we are urging. In 1899, in the Rio Grande case, this court appeared to adopt a rule of reason test in defining the meaning of Section 10. And its definition of that test is essentially the same that we are offering to this court today. In the Sanitary District in Wisconsin cases, the court held that Section 10 was applicable to water diversions from Lake Michigan that reduced shipping capacity in the Great Lakes region by about 3 million tons each year, and thus had a substantial effect on the rights of the many states that bordered Lake Michigan.
But that was because the state was a party. And when states are parties, this court has original jurisdiction, and we have to fashion a body of common law.
Yes, well, that's correct. So the court obviously had to reach the question in that case, and you're suggesting the possibility that the court may not have to do so here. But nonetheless, the Sanitary District case stands for the proposition that where there's an effect on federal navigation interests, as there were in that case in Lake Michigan, then Section 10 surely applies. But we don't have that kind of an effect in this case. So essentially, we are arguing that the court should accommodate federal and state interests in this case by seeking an accommodation or balance of these interests in the fields of reclamation and navigation. This is the same test the court followed in the Rio Grande case. We urge that it be followed here. And I would like, if I may, Mr. Chief Justice, reserve a few moments for rebuttal.
Very well. Mrs. Stillman.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Federal respondents were brought into this case as defendants, as counsel for California has indicated, with respect to a federal pumping plant that also pumped water to the south part of the state. Because that pumping plant was determined by the Court of Appeals to be authorized by Congress, it's out of the case up here, and the court has not granted the petition that challenges that holding. Corps of Engineers were also named as defendants in this case, although no relief was sought directly against them. The federal pumping plant officials and the state pumping plant officials were ordered to apply for permits to the Corps, and the Corps has been processing the state's permits, both, I understand, for the current Delta pumping plant and for a planned expansion of that pumping plant.
Your position here as a respondent is supporting the judgment below?
We are here supporting petitioners on one issue and private respondents on one issue, Your Honor.
What's your primary argument is that the Court of Appeals was mistaken in believing that there was a private cause of action, and you ask us to remand the case with directions to dismiss it.
That's correct. We believe that there was.
But you say that if we disagree with you on that.
That's correct. Then you should affirm it on the merits.
Right.
That's correct.
But
yes.
Did the government take this position with respect to the Delta plant in the lower courts?
The government took not much of any position with respect to the Delta plant in the
so
lower
your
courts.
Answer is no, it didn't.
No, but it didn't take a con. Well, it.
Well, it did not press this argument about the Delta plant.
Correct.
Either the district. Court
That's
or
correct.
The court
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. But it certainly never, at any time, took the position that the state is exempt from the act, or that state water allocation systems are exempt from the act, or the types of arguments that the state
you
is pressing here.
Didn't cross-claim against the.
No, we did not, Your Honor. And
which you could have done.
Could have brought our own action.
Why didn't the Corps bring its own action if it wants this case affirmed on the merits, if it's determined that there is a private cause of action?
Your Honor, the factual situation in the Delta is that there is some change in water levels. We think that the characterization of that and net flow reversals, we think the characterization of that physical situation by the state as being something very de minimis and beneath notice is incorrect, but characterizations by the private respondents that they're egregious violations, which were obvious to everybody, we think is also incorrect. We think that it's a situation there which, when finally and fully brought to the attention of the Corps and with due reflection, they recognized as meeting the threshold requirements of Clause 3 and requiring a permit, and that's what they're processing at the present time. In this court, therefore, as they did below, the federal respondents are challenging the right of the Sierra Club to bring the suit, and they're saying the state is wrong in suggesting that there's some sort of special exemption for states or for states with state water allocation systems or for state water allocation systems that don't substantially impair navigation. I will devote the first part of my presentation to the private right of action issue, since we agree that that's the threshold issue and you don't reach the question on the merits if you agree with us on that issue. In recent decisions of this court concerning the question whether a private right of action under a federal statute may be implied from the terms of that statute, this court has made it clear that the critical question is congressional intent. I refer to cases such as Transamerica Mortgage Investors Association, Touche Ross, Cannon against University of Chicago, and the Amtrak case. This court has indicated in those same decisions that there are various critical categories of evidence respecting congressional intent, critical in showing an absence of any intent to create a specific implied remedy under the Act. One critical factor is whether the statute contains within itself a specific remedy, and moreover, a remedy that is specifically entrusted to federal officers to enforce. Another critical factor is whether it appears that Congress enacted the statute for the benefit of the public at large, or whether it enacted the statute for the benefit of a special class. We submit that with respect to Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act, both of those factors are present and that they indicate that there was no intent on the part of Congress to include an implied private remedy to enforce the statute. In Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act, Congress has devised a scheme entrusting to an expert federal administrative body the task of determining whether certain types of obstructions to navigable capacity are unreasonable types of obstructions and therefore should not be permitted. That body of experts is the Secretary of War, later the Secretary of Army, and the Chief of Engineers and the Corps of Engineers. If it appears that someone is in violation of the Act and efforts by the Corps to secure compliance are unavailing, the Corps can go to the U.S. Attorney, to the Justice Department, and suggest to them that action in court is advisable.
Did you say that this very expert body let this mischief, if it be a mischief under the Court of Appeals decision, go on for unchecked for a long period of time until its attention was called to it by private litigants?
I'm not sure how long it went on. I'm not sure that it appeared, it didn't appear overnight a decade ago. I think it might have been gradual. And we assert that the Corps is expert. We don't assert that it's infallible. But we think that
even
Congress,
when speaking on matters of faith and morals,
yes. Only when speaking on matters of navigability. If it appears that someone is in violation, then if the Corps thinks that court action is necessary, it may ask the U.S. Attorney to seek appropriate relief, and this may be criminal penalties. It also may be injunctive relief, and Section 406 of the Act, which is the enforcement provision for Section 10, specifically provides for both. I might call the Court's attention to the fact that, of course, Section 406, where it says that courts will have jurisdiction to enjoin the removal of structures in the waters found illegal under Section 9 or 10, this Court in Republic Steel has construed that as much broader. That is, that the U.S. Attorney, when he is seeking remedies against violations of the Act, is not, in fact, limited to the literal language of that sentence. And in making that judgment, the Court emphasized that the reason he is not limited to that is because Congress in this statute was securing the interests of the United States, and in Section 17 of the Act, they said the Department of Justice shall conduct these proceedings to enforce all necessary proceedings to enforce the provisions. And there was a very strong strain in the Republic Steel case emphasizing that we have to have a broad remedy here because this is the interests of the United States that are being enforced here, and the powers of the Attorney General are brought to bear in these proceedings. And I don't think you can read from that case a sense that the broad types of equitable relief which might be sought by private parties are contained in the Act because Congress wanted private parties to have those powers. Now some of the courts in the Sierra Club say, well, Section 17 only concerns criminal proceedings. That's only saying that the Department of Justice is the one to bring these criminal proceedings. But this means that the phrase, all proceedings necessary to enforce the Act, doesn't include injunctive relief, and that just can't be true because injunctive relief is obviously quite critical to the enforcement of the statute. And Section 17 says the Department of Justice shall control those proceedings. Language expressly assigning enforcement of a statute to federal officers, of course, is not absolutely preclusive of a private right of action, although extremely strong evidence. But here, as we have noted, it is strengthened by the second consideration, that this statute was enacted to protect the right of the public at large, and it was not enacted for a special class, as this Court has found in other statutes such as the Voting Rights Act in the Allen case. And in fact, in the Cannon decision, in footnote 13 of the Cannon decision, the Court specifically describes the Rivers and Harbors Act as a statute enacted to protect the rights of the public at large. Now, the Sierra Club has argued that Congress must have intended to authorize suits under Section 10 of the Act by private parties suffering special damages because Congress would have been aware of the principle that persons suffering a private nuisance may sometimes enjoin a public nuisance where they have special damages. They have also suggested that Congress must have contemplated such private enforcement of the Act because it was concerned with this Court's decision in the Willamette Bridge case, and a case that was brought by private parties and dismissed because there was no federal law for them to bring the case
under. Did you suggest that injunctive proceedings under 17 may be brought only by the Department of Justice? How about the Corps of Engineers?
The Corps of Engineers requests the Department of Justice to bring the proceedings. Their lawyers may sit there.
Well, request, but can Justice turn them down?
No. Yes, I believe Justice could.
Similarly, with Interior?
Yes.
Well, that's always been a hotly contested matter within the executive branch, has it not? Whether or not the Department of Justice shall control the litigation of federal claims,
that's
or
right.
Whether other agencies within the executive branch shall have the right to their own representation.
That's correct, Your Honor. But in this case, it says in Section 17, the Department of Justice shall all proceedings to enforce the provisions of this Act. So I think it's less of a question.
So if somebody goes forward with a diversion without a permit, the only thing the Corps can do about it is to ask the Justice to bring suit.
Yes.
And if the Justice Department says, sorry, no permit is required, that's the end of it.
However hotly contested the Department of Justice, the Attorney General has invariably prevailed, has he not?
Yes, I would think so. There's not a sense to second-guess policy decisions of agencies, certainly in the Justice Department. The Sierra Club also relies, as I say, on the Willamette case. These arguments might have some force if Congress had written a statute different from the one that they wrote. But they didn't write a statute simply saying, thus and such a structure shall be a nuisance, or an unconsented structure shall be unlawful. They wrote this statute that creates this system of review. And I think to emphasize the problems or to illustrate the problems with the Sierra Club's argument, we might profitably look at the Willamette Bridge case itself. That case involved plans to construct a bridge over the Willamette River, which the decision says was a river the navigable portion, indicates that the navigable portions of that river were entirely within the state of Oregon. That would mean that the construction of that bridge would come within Section 9 of the Rivers and Harbors Act, and it would not need the consent of Congress because the navigable portions of the river are entirely in the state. All it would need would be that the plans should be approved by the Chief of Engineers. After the Rivers and Harbors Act were passed, if this statute is construed as we say it should be construed, what Senator Dolph's clients, Mr. Hatch and his co-plaintiffs, would have done is go to the local Corps of Engineers and say, these people are planning to build this bridge over the Willamette River, and they haven't gotten their plans approved by you. And the Corps could go to the bridge builders and say, you can't build that bridge unless you show us your plans and we approve them. If there was refusal and noncompliance, the Corps of Engineers could go to the Department of Justice and say, enjoin the building of that bridge because they're going to build it on improper plans. However, if the Corps of Engineers looked at the plans and said, those plans look fine to us, go ahead and build your bridge, even if Senator Dolph's clients, Mr. Hatch and his co-plaintiffs, didn't like it and thought the bridge would still be inconvenient to them, they would have no rights under this act to say that bridge is a nuisance, don't build it, because this act doesn't protect the individual's convenience. It protects the rights of the public.
Would it make that decision reviewable at all?
You mean the decision of the Corps? I think the situation now with the Administrative Procedure Act, that it probably would be reviewable.
But
I think at the time that the 1899 Act was passed, it probably wasn't.
Well, it is today, though.
Probably now, yes. But if you're talking about the intent of Congress in 1899.
Well, I'm talking about would a decision like that be reviewable today or not?
Probably so.
It's agency action, I suspect it would, although it's discretionary, and there's a question of whether.
Well, suppose a diversion from a navigable river is made by a person who asks for a permit from the Corps of Engineers, and they say, oh, well, you don't need a permit. I'm not going to give you a permit. You just don't need one.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody downstream says, well, you did need a permit, and furthermore, the water level's lowered, and I can't get water out of the river anymore. In my distribution system. So he wants to sue for damages. He wants damages, and he wants it adjudicated that a permit was required.
Well, if he really wants damages, he can sue in his state court. We're talking about federal court actions here. Why does he have to sue under this statute?
Does your same argument apply to a damages action brought by a private individual under the Act?
Yes, I think it does. We think this Act creates no private right of action. I might say on that it's evident to us that it's very complicated trying to fit these very different types of private right of actions, these private actions that the Sierra Club is relying on to dovetail them with the statute. And for this reason, Congress not having said anything on this subject as to how these were to fit, we can't see that they really had any intent of there being private actions here.
Isn't your position, just so I have it clear, in the case that Justice White proposes, that the proper procedure that Congress intended was sue in the state court, and if you lose there, then you can appeal or petition for certiorari to this court, which would then construe Section Rivers and Harbors.
I don't think it would be a question of the Rivers and Harbors Act in state court. They'd have a common law nuisance action in the state court, not an action under this statute.
So you're not just saying there's no federal private cause, there is just no remedy under the...
Under the Rivers and Harbors Act, that's right, but they...
Even if there's a private violation.
That's right. But if they have any remedies under state law or traditional nuisance actions, they could go to the state courts for that. It's not preemptive. We're not saying it's preemptive of state nuisance actions.
But what would prevent a state court from saying, well, we think if you violate the federal statute, we ought to give a remedy? Is there anything that would prevent that?
The state wanted to say that.
They're in violation of federal law, but you say there's no federal remedy. Why can't the state provide that? All state judges swear to uphold the federal law.
Well, if the question of whether a private remedy is included in a federal statute is a question of congressional intent.
Even as respects an action in a state court.
Sure.
Yes, yes, yes. We think that there was no intent to create a private remedy in this statute, that this was a statute to be enforced by the Department of Justice, as the Congress said in Section 17.
This is not to say that a California court, state court, couldn't say, as a matter of state law,
sure,
we find that anything that violates the federal
sure
act is a nuisance.
Certainly. If they wanted to say that as a matter of state law, I don't think there'd be. It's not preemptive in that sense.
Their historical argument is that there had been private actions to try and prevent bridges and one thing or the other, and then that this statute was enacted to make something unlawful that the court had not been willing to hold on.
Well, we think
not to change the remedial setup at all.
But we think it did change the remedial setup because of the way the statute was instructed.
Away a remedy that was
yes. Yes. And we think that if you look at Senator Vest's comments, he thought really what you needed was federal enforcement here, that that's what would take care of the situation.
There could be nothing else, too?
He did not specifically say there can be nothing else, but there's certainly no statement by anyone that we're hereby creating a private right of action. I'd like to...
Or even preserving one.
We don't think there was any federal cause of action before this, and this statute.
Well, there were
1890
federal injunction
Act
actions.
Or the 1899 Act.
Neither one did it create one. I'd like to just touch briefly on our arguments against the state's claims that it's exempt from this act. I won't address their claim that they make in their brief that states don't even come under the act at all, because we can't believe that they're seriously pressing that claim. I would like to address its contention that state water allocation systems are somehow exempt from the act, and simply to say that there's nothing in the language of the act that very clearly covers any disturbance of navigability or any alteration in condition, and Clause 3 has to be looked at by the court. It says nothing about unless it's part of a state water allocation system. I might say also that that's an extremely amorphous category, state water allocation systems. I think
it's very... What if one were to find a conflict between the Reclamation Act of 1902 and the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899?
Your Honor, I can't see any conflict in here, because in Section 8 of the 1902 Act, they said they preserved existing state authority to control their water acts. Well, existing state authority was qualified by the requirements of the Rivers
but
and Harbors
about
of Act
Section
of 1899.
One, saying that the project should be constructed in conformity with state law and I don't remember the language.
Your Honor, as I read your opinion in California versus United States, you say that where state law is inconsistent with congressional directives, that it doesn't prevail.
Well, but and, don't you at least have to look at the two together?
Well, yes, but it seems to me that as I read California against United States, it says if there's a congressional directive that's inconsistent with state law, it prevails. And here we have a congressional directive in the Rivers and Harbors Act that says if you alter the conditions of navigable waters, we agree there's a de minimis standard there, by the way, and if it has the potential, we believe that's what Clause 3 really means. These are things that might have the potential for disturbing navigability, and they're something that the Corps should take a look at and decide whether they should be permitted or not. What the state is saying is read that clause out and don't let the government look at us until there's a fait accompli. Now, that's not the scheme of the statute. The statute is let the Corps look at it and decide whether there's going to be a serious disturbance of navigability. And if there is, they won't permit it. If there is not, they will allow it. I will agree that in their permitting process now, as it's changed recently, they look at things beyond that. They now look at environmental factors because of the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act, in other words.
Well, the Court of Appeals told them that's what they should do.
Yes. I do not agree, though. We do not accept the suggestions by California that the Corps decides this person should have water and that person shouldn't have water. Stockton should have water and California shouldn't. They look always to the effects on the water, the effects on water.
But if it's an environmental standard or some other standard other than navigational, the Court of Appeals told them to, that's okay.
Yes, although
to apply the public interest generally.
Strictly speaking, strictly speaking, I think that question is not here on review. The Zabel—that's really the Zabel v. Tabb issue. And what's what the state is claiming that they don't even come under Clause 3 as it was as it was enacted in 1899, and that clearly is wrong. Whether the Fifth Circuit is right, as we think it was in Zabel v. Tabb, that the court can look at these other environmental factors, I think, is not here to be decided in this case.
Thank you, Ms. Stone.
Thank you.
Mr. Clark?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, if I may, I would like to address first the question of the private right of the plaintiffs to bring this suit. And at the outset, I would like to emphasize that unlike the situation of the plaintiffs in the Amtrak, the Touche Ross, the Cannon, and the Transamerica cases, we are not proposing that this Court try to discern from the legislative language an intent to create a new and different private cause of action that did not exist before. We agree that the test here is legislative intent. And unlike the dilemma that we frequently find ourselves in, here we are able to gauge legislative intent quite accurately. And I think it's possible in this case to actually determine the state of mind of the congressman who enacted the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1890, which was the predecessor of the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899, and which all counsel agree, I believe, is the relevant statute for determining the legislative intent behind the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899. Counsel has agreed, and I think the federal defendants have acknowledged in their brief, that the purpose of the Congress when they enacted the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1890 was, in effect, to overrule a decision of this Court in Willamette Iron Bridge Company versus Hess. For that reason, I think it instructive to go back to Willamette Iron Bridge versus Hatch and examine how that case would have been decided with the change that was wrought by Congress when it enacted the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1890. Now, Willamette Iron Bridge versus Hatch was a suit brought by a citizen of Oregon against another citizen of Oregon to abate a nuisance. He relied upon what he asserted was a statute of the United States that rendered unlawful the construction of a bridge that obstructed navigation. He said, that bridge is a nuisance because it obstructs navigation and it is made unlawful by an act of Congress.
He didn't need to have the ladder taken, did he?
He did, I believe, Your Honor, in that case because he was suing in a federal court and he sought federal relief
It was a nuisance.
But, Your Honor, his only basis of federal jurisdiction.
It was a nuisance because it was obstructing navigation?
Yes, Your Honor, but it was between the citizens of the same state. He had no jurisdiction in federal court unless he could show that his case arose under a federal statute. So he relied upon that statute which admitted Oregon into the Union and contained some language that recited that the Willamette River would be forever free for navigation. He said, the construction of that bridge obstructed navigation, and it provided the necessary element of a private cause of action for nuisance, that is, that the obstruction was unlawful. And this Court said to him, just as it had said in a string of very similar cases decided in the 19th century in language that sounds like it was directed at Congress rather than to the private litigants, that you are right every step of the way with one exception. There is no federal statute which makes the obstruction of a navigable waterway unlawful. Now, that was the culmination of a series of cases, many of which, or a number of which at least, came to this Court and were decided the same way. And within 2 years, Congress had enacted the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1890. And I believe that what Congress intended quite clearly from the enactment of that particular statute was to put Mr. Hatch in the position where if that lawsuit had been brought after the enactment of that particular law, he would have prevailed. He would have prevailed on the theory of a private nuisance, and he would have to have shown that he was specially injured just as anyone would have to have done at that point in time and today in order to prevail on a claim of a private nuisance.
He wouldn't have had to show that the navigability of a navigable stream was obstructed?
He would have, Your Honor. He would have had to show some sort of obstruction. I don't think that obstruction was the only ground of nuisance at that point in time. There were other things one could do to a river that constituted nuisance, but he would have to have shown something other than injury to himself.
But as I read the 1890 Act, it speaks in terms of the federal interest being obstructions to navigation.
Yes, I think that's true. That was not the only purpose of that act, I would submit, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. I believe this Court has held in the Standard Oil case, for example, that Congress intended to protect the interest of the nation in both navigable waterways and pure waterways when it enacted the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899. And that is the reason that in addition to Sections 10 and 12, upon which plaintiffs rely here, it also enacted a number of other sections designed to prevent dumping and pollution. It did not use the word pollution, but it enacted a number of other sections designed to keep our waterways clean.
Well, do you think that kind of a were you saying that that kind of a case would technically arise under a federal statute and give a federal district court jurisdiction?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, all you're saying it's a cause of action for nuisance.
Your Honor, I'm
saying. You aren't saying, I guess what you're arguing is that this isn't, that kind of a case wouldn't be a private cause of action under the Rivers and Harbors Act at all?
Well, Your Honor, that is largely,
federal jurisdiction.
That is largely true. It arises, what Congress intended to do, and I think quite clearly intended to do, was provide a federal statute so that this kind of action would in fact arise under federal law. And I think a consideration of the alternative to that conclusion indicates very strongly why Congress must have so intended.
What if they brought it to state court?
That is the alternative, Your Honor.
Well, then would it be controlled by federal law or state law as to what a nuisance is?
I think it would be controlled by federal law if the nuisance actions could be brought in state courts, but we would not have a uniform development of the law in that particular area. The interpretation of the Rivers and Harbors Act in that instance would be left to all the superior courts and state courts of this country.
Well, it sounds to me like you're reading the arising under jurisdiction much like the savings to suitors and admiralty clause in the Constitution, as if it were preserving a particular right rather than simply allowing Congress to create rights.
Your Honor, that may be. I think what I'm attempting to do primarily is to determine what Congress actually intended. However we may characterize it today, I think it is true, and I think it is the most logical and probable interpretation of the intent of Congress back in the last century, that when it enacted this particular law, it did contemplate the bringing of actions of this kind.
The Court of Appeals didn't agree with you on that point, did
it? The Court of Appeals did agree, Mr. Justice.
The Court of Appeals said it was neither one.
No, they held that there is a private right of action.
Yeah, but I mean, then they said that the congressional history didn't help them.
They said it was not clear. As the opinion was written.
But you say it is clear.
I think it is. And I think it is made clear in part by the further research that has been done in preparation for this particular argument. I think our brief lays out in rather extensive detail the considerations not only of the legislative history of this act, but the contemporaneous legal context in which this statute was enacted. It was somewhat different back then from what it is today, and as we have attempted to argue in our brief, suits by private suitors were the norm, and enforcement by federal agencies was the exception. That has somewhat been reversed in the 80 years since the enactment of the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899. But back then, to assume that private suitors would be able to enforce this particular act was not unusual at all. And it certainly was not the kind of situation that this Court was confronted with in the recent decisions in Transamerica, Canon, and so on, in which you do not have that kind of background and you are attempting to determine whether Congress, when it enacted a new regulatory scheme intended as a part of that, to also give private suitors the right to enforce that particular new law. That was
so
not...
On private action, you want to move us back to the 19th century?
No, I think we have to go back there because of this Court's pronouncements that we look to congressional intent. The intent of Congress that is relevant starts back in the 19th century, and I think it continues to this very day, because since the enactment of the Rivers and Harbors Act, there has been engrafted upon that statute a number of additional further requirements that are of particular importance to the plaintiffs who bring this suit: the Federal Water Pollution Control Act, the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act, the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969, the National Estuarine Areas Act, all of which, to one extent or another, must be taken into account by the Corps of Engineers when it passes upon applications for permits and exercises its jurisdiction over the navigable waters of the United States.
Mark, may I interrupt?
Yes.
Putting the case back in the 1890 context that you asked us to do, as I understand your argument, the private plaintiff would have had to allege something akin to a private nuisance, a very
yes.
direct entry to himself, his own interest.
Right.
Now, do your clients qualify for that type of standard?
Yes, they do.
Which is the one that best qualifies in a sense? Certainly, that you don't have an obstruction to navigation.
Well, I think we do, Mr. Justice Stevens. It is true, of course, that one of the concerns of our clients is the environment, but we represent clients who use the waters of the Delta for navigation as well as for recreational interests. So we...
Do you allege that their use of the waters for navigation will be impaired?
Yes, we do.
That's the Sierra Club and Schramm, the fisherman?
Hank Schramm, Your Honor.
Schramm, he was in San Francisco Bay.
Yes, he fishes in San Francisco Bay. He is not affected by the lowering of water levels by having the navigation of his boat impeded. He, however, fishes for salmon. 80% of the salmon fishery that works out of San Francisco Bay is entirely dependent upon the Delta environment for the production of that particular anadromous fish that goes up into freshwater, lays its eggs, and fish and swims out into the salt water of the ocean. So he is affected, and he has a very serious economic interest in this particular action.
His navigability is not affected.
But there are members of the plaintiff's
and
classes.
And yet you're relying on the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899 as granting a private cause of action.
Yes.
And that was concerned
exclusively with navigation.
Well, I think not. But let me assume, arguendo, that it is concerned exclusively with navigation. In that instance, we would be required to show an effect on navigation, and we believe we have done that. I might advise the Court of one factor that I think has not been made clear in the past, and that is that the trial below was a bifurcated trial. And the Court entered an order that no evidence of the damage caused by these particular diversions should be admitted until the second phase of the bifurcated trial. So the issue that has been resolved to date is an issue of standing. Now, I think there is no difference between standing and that special injury. I may be mistaken in that regard. But at the very least, standing to bring these suits and the special injury that was traditionally required in a private nuisance suit.
It seems to me there is a difference. It seems to be the inability to get salmon would be, satisfy an Article III standing requirement. It wouldn't constitute an impediment to your ability to navigate wherever you want to navigate.
That may well be.
And is there anything in the record that indicates that any of your clients, by reason of what your adversaries are doing, cannot navigate in the way they like to navigate?
Yes. We allege, Mr. Justice Stevens, that our clients, the members of the plaintiff classes, use the Delta waters for boating, and they have been impeded.
Can't go.
I'm sorry?
Well, go ahead. Sorry, I shouldn't have interrupted. You finish your sentence.
We'd simply allege that navigability has been affected, and there has been minimal proof on that issue through the first phase of the bifurcated trial.
It doesn't seem to me that lowering the water table a few inches would satisfy the requirement, if we can still navigate any place you could previously navigate.
Well, it might mean you couldn't tie up the same docks, or it might make some marinas unusable.
Well, we've heard this morning that a lowering of 6 inches affected trade on the Great Lakes by 300 million tons or dollars. I know that figure. I'm probably not reciting it correctly. But I would submit to you that one of the things Congress had in mind when it enacted this statute is that neither this court nor any other court should be determining such issues as whether or not 1 inch of lowered water level at one particular point had that effect on navigation that would trigger the effects of this particular act. Congress said that is a role that the Corps of Engineers and the Secretary of War were to play, and that the initial step in compliance with the Rivers and Harbors Act was to go to them and seek a permit. If it was true, as California contends, that there is nothing in their proposed and continuing diversions of water that is prohibited by the Rivers and Harbors Act, then in that event, the result should be the issuance of a permit forthwith. That is the way the statute was intended to operate. But the state of California and, to date, the federal defendants have chosen not to comply with that particular law insofar as it applies to any of the water projects that divert water from Northern California to.
If you want to take us back to the 1890s, as you have on for some purposes, wasn't it true in the 1890s and for many decades thereafter that no private claimant would have had any right to challenge the action of the Corps of Engineers in refusing or in granting a permit?
I don't know. I do not think that's correct. I think they would have had a right of mandamus that would have given them a limited right. There are cases in which private suitors have sought and, I think, obtained mandamus against the Corps.
Certainly nothing like the Administrative Procedure
Act. No. The Administrative Procedure Act, of course, was not available. But what people, in fact, did, and I think a test of the theory that I advance here, is to go to the courts, the federal courts, and assert actions under the Rivers and Harbors Act. And a test of whether my analysis of congressional intent is correct, I would submit, is what the courts in fact did when private litigants came to them and made the same sort of claim that the Sierra Club and the other private individual plaintiffs have made here. They treated them as plaintiffs who had a private right of action under the Rivers and Harbors Act, and they granted the injunctive kind of relief, the very kind of relief that Mr. Hatch sought against Willamette Iron Bridge back in 1886. And the cases, the Chatfield case, the Carver case cited in our brief, arose under very similar factual situations.
None of those are from this court.
That's true, I think, Your Honor. They are not from this court. The decision of this court that probably is most in point is the Wyandotte case, cited in Court versus Ash and in Cannon as one in which this court implied a right of action under the Rivers and Harbors Act to be true in favor of the United States. In Court versus Ash, that was cited as a finding of a case that stood for the proposition that there is, in fact, a private right of action under the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899. In the Cannon case, that characterization was moderated somewhat and was simply one in which this court noted that in the Wyandotte case, it had implied a right of action that was not specifically provided for in the Rivers and Harbors Act that is not significantly different from the kind of relief that these private plaintiffs seek here. And I think there is little reason for the United States to have that kind of relief in its proprietary capacity and yet deny that same kind of relief.
Could I ask you what the elevation of the Tracy plant or the Delta plant is?
Above sea level, Your Honor? I believe that the elevation is substantially at sea level.
Well, then, suppose you diverted entirely the Sacramento River.
Yes.
Above the Delta Plain. If it's substantially at sea level, then there would be just as much water at the Delta plant. The only thing is it would be seawater.
That's right.
So that wouldn't affect navigation any.
Your Honor, it would in this sense.
Well, you'd be still, if the water level would be set substantially the same level.
Well, I disagree with your premise with all due respect.
What premise? I asked you how high it was, and you said it was substantially sea level.
Yes. The elevation of the Delta pumping plant will not change, and if it is at sea level, that is where it is. But the level of the water will change, and whatever mean lower low or mean lower high water may be at any particular point, at any particular time, when the Delta pumps start to pump water, the water levels in the adjacent waterways goes down. Yes, it comes back in sometime.
The Pacific Ocean is a pretty adequate supply.
The quantity is adequate, Your Honor. The supply, the quality, though, is something else.
Well, yes, but if we were talking navigation.
If we're talking navigation, we can talk navigation. And when we
it certainly changes the character of the river from freshwater to seawater, which is a substantial change.
It does more than that. Yes, Justice White, it is, and I believe that quality of water is a Rivers and Harbors Act concern, but I want to make very clear that we believe the plaintiffs satisfy a strictly navigational test. If this court were to say you cannot assert a right under the Rivers and Harbors Act without showing that you were privately and personally affected in some effort to navigate these waters, we think we can show that. We do not believe that is a correct way to apply the Act.
You think you can show it. Shouldn't you have shown that at the first day of trial?
I think not, Your Honor.
You never accepted the premise.
We don't accept the premise, but we also are under an order that defers until the second phase of a bifurcated trial all proof of the damage caused to these plaintiffs by these particular diversions.
If you're looking at remedy, that's certainly a normal way to bifurcate a trial. If you're looking at authority to proceed with litigation, it's a rather strange bifurcation.
Well, Your Honor, that is simply the way this case has gotten up to this particular court. I don't think the...
Well, if it's a jurisdictional question, just bifurcating the trial doesn't give the court some jurisdiction it doesn't have.
No, but
first issue addressed by both Judge Renfrew and the Court of Appeals was private cause of action.
That's right. And he found, and the Court of Appeals found, that we had satisfied those tests on the record before those courts. And I think the record is sufficient. I think we have
it. It isn't sufficient if you're saying to us, we can prove it if you let us go back and do it in the second stage of the trial. But don't we have to take the record as it's made up to now?
No, I don't think you could dismiss these plaintiffs on the ground that in the middle of the trial, a trial that specifically deferred until a second phase, certain elements of proof. I don't think you could dismiss now on the ground that those deferred elements of proof had not yet been proven.
Well, you just disagree with Renfrew and the Court of Appeals.
Oh, yes, of course.
We can just disagree with them.
Yes.
That there was, on the grounds that there was no private question, or I suppose we could say that, disagree with them, that the threshold showing of any injury to these people was shown by the surveys.
Well, I think that an examination of the record will show that there is ample proof in the record of an actual injury to navigation. That issue has not been argued on appeal. The issue that has been raised is whether there is a private right.
Contention that the substitution of salt water, Pacific Ocean water, for fresh water is itself an obstruction to navigation?
No, Mr. Justice Stewart, that is not our position.
I mean, salt water is more buoyant.
It may be. And I would emphasize that the lower court found, as a matter of fact, that there was an obstruction to navigation. That was a factual founding made. Yes. No, the evidence on which that was based is not confined to a lowering of 1 inch. That was counsel's statement. The record shows that the lowering of water levels is 18 inches at some points under the present amount of pumping. And one must bear in mind that the present pumping is far less than the volume of pumping contemplated by these particular defendants.
Down to the lower part of the state.
Yes. They propose substantial additional pumping.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Was not the obstruction to navigation something that was yet to be built in the peripheral canal, and that there is no showing that that particular obstruction interfered with your client's ability to navigate?
No,
am I wrong?
I think you're wrong, Mr. Justice.
What is it in the record, just so I can pinpoint something, on which, if you had to rely on the present record, what could you point to say that there's anything showing any interference with any of your client's present ability to navigate?
Just the proof, Your Honor, that water levels have been reduced and that the plaintiffs use the waters of the Delta for boating and other purposes.
Is there someplace they can't go or couldn't go when this thing was built that they can go now?
I think that is the fact, Mr. Justice, but I don't believe that's the state of proof at this stage of the trial down below. We are under an order of the court that was issued at the time the interveners were granted the right to intervene that said that proof of the effect of these diversions would be deferred until the second phase of the trial. So although the record happens to have a substantial quantity of evidence on the effect of these diversions, it is there largely because it is in evidence introduced for other purposes. And the proof of the extent of the effect of these diversions has been deferred until the second phase. I might mention that while I'm on this point that we take the position that in terms of substantive proof, substantive application of the Act itself, we must only show that the defendants are engaged in conduct in the kind of conduct referred to in the second or third clauses of Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act, and a showing of that fact is sufficient to require a ruling that they seek a proper permit and approval from the Corps of Engineers.
You have a private cause of action.
Assuming we have a private cause of action. Thank you.
Just very briefly, Mr. Justice Brennan, the Sierra Club has stated that assuming that the Corps of Engineers has jurisdiction, the Corps should be allowed to deny the permit on any non-navigational grounds, such as on any solely environmental grounds. I might point out to the Court that position, although very consistent with the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case, is inconsistent with the position expressed by the United States in its own brief. For at page 31 of the United States brief, last full sentence, the United States makes the following statement. We assume, moreover, that an alteration or modification must be of a type with the potential for affecting navigation, i.e., that water quality alterations would not be covered unless they are of a type with a potential for reducing stream capacity, for example, by increasing siltation, end quote. Thus, the position of the Sierra Club and the United States on the merits of this case is apparently at odds according to their oral arguments. I would further point out that according to the facts of the case, yes, indeed, there are some effects in this case caused by the water exports upon Delta environmental quality. Those effects largely relate to salinity intrusion, just as it has been pointed out. The State Water Resources Control Board, in the process of issuing appropriated water rights permits to the State Water Project, has essentially dealt with those kinds of concerns and has worked out a finely tuned program to ameliorate or perhaps avoid those salinity intrusion problems altogether. So the state has performed a very active function and role in the process of trying to determine the allocation of water between Northern and Central and Southern California needs. And it is our view that the state's role should be maintained, that the program developed by the State Water Resources Control Board should be upheld, and that the Corps of Engineers should not have the power to override it or veto it in the absence of some kind of discernible, substantial effect upon federal navigation interests. And those, that kind of an effect simply doesn't exist here.
Are you saying that would you have the same, that's just changing fresh water to salt water would not, for example, would not...
has no navigational effect that we're aware of, and the court and the lower courts did not so hold.
Well, barnacles accumulate a lot faster on sailing vessels.
Well, it's possible. I suppose it's hypothetically possible that such an effect could take place, but if so, the lower court would have to consider that question, make factual findings on it. The lower court didn't do that in this case because it held that the act was triggered merely by the fact that the water exports in this case have solely environmental effects.
Is it true that the Delta pumping plant will reduce the level of the water in the river at that point and downriver to a certain extent?
According to the lower district court's findings, the pumping plants would reduce water levels in the Delta, in the interior Delta channels where commerce actually takes place, by about 1 inch. And that is the combined export of water both by the state pumping plant and by the federal pumping plant. That's correct, yes. But the district court also held that in the area near the pumping plants, where there is no commerce, the water exports, the combined exports from both the federal and state projects would there reduce Delta water levels by about this much, a foot and a half. But our position is that there is no actual commerce or navigation that takes place in those exterior Delta channels that are near the pumping plants.
Well, that's just maybe by happenstance. I mean, it could, couldn't it?
Well, in the real world, I don't think it's plausible to expect that ships would be plying
ships,
the tribute.
You're talking about logs or anything else. Canoes full of fur.
But the area we're talking about, Justice White, are channels that lead away from the mainstream of the Delta down to the pumping plants. And there's no logs and no ships and nothing else that applies those particular waters. Thank you.
Case is submitted.